I work on climate change because I think we are choosing to fail, but we could choose to succeed. There is a choice in there. And when many mean succeed, I think we could hold the temperature rise to about 2 degrees centigrade. I think that is still viable. If you ask me in 5 years or 10 years' time, I probably would say it would no longer be viable. I think it's still viable just today. I don't think 1.5 is any longer viable unless the negative emission technologies work and then work at scale. And that's a very big if.
Welcome to the podcast Beyond 1 Degree. This is Martin Hedberg. In this episode, we will meet Kevin Anderson, Professor of Climate and Energy at the University of Manchester. I had a conversation with him in Stockholm 20th of February 2017.
We live in a radical extreme group and we have normalized it. And that is the real danger, that we don't recognize how bizarre and abstract our lifestyles have become. If you add a weak element of equity into this, the poorer parts of the world need to be zero carbon energy by 2050 and need to be really moving towards mitigation, reducing their emissions by the very early 2020s. We need to start in the wealthier parts of the world right now, reducing our emissions very rapidly indeed, certainly over 10% per annum, and need to be zero carbon energy by about 2035.
Of course, scientists have different personalities and Kevin is no exception. He likes rock climbing and biking. He's very keen on changing the world to something better, or at least trying to avoid a disaster. And as you will hear in the podcast, he can be quite critical not only to the wealthy world, but also to himself and scientific colleagues. He thinks scientists should live their learning better, and he finds it problematic when they travel around the world to participate in conferences and negotiations, as if their emissions doesn't count just because they have good intentions. Well, nature don't care. It's obvious that Kevin has a deep knowledge not only about the science of climate and energy, but also about its implications upon real life. He is critical to unrealistic technical solutions that yet has to be invented in order to avoid catastrophes.
It's a very dangerous game to play, in my view. So that's that, you know, it's like it's the Russian roulette. You know, you wouldn't want to do it at all. And the first group say taking one pull of the trigger, and the other group say, well, I'm happy to take 3 or 4 pulls of the trigger. Well, yeah. I don't think that's particularly wise to deal with the future of society or indeed many ecosystems.
He also highlights the big asymmetry in responsibility among different people. It is clear that most of the world's 7+ billion people cannot do very much about changing the planetary radiation budget. But half of the world's total emissions of carbon dioxide comes from only 1/10 of the world population. If these top emitters would reduce their emissions to the level of an average EU citizens, the total global emissions would be reduced by 33%.
So we could choose to succeed. My guess about the future is that we will choose to fail. And let's not pretend that it's not a choice. It is a choice. So what is it that's important about our lives? And this is where I think there's more hope in Sweden, that your value system isn't yet quite as simplified as it is in somewhere like the UK, the US, where value is just simply what do you own? How much stuff do you consume? How big is your house? How big is your car? Do you fly first class and how far do you go? And that pretty much says what you need to know about a person in the UK or the States. There still seems to be something a bit richer and deeper in Sweden. You haven't forgotten some of those other values.
Kevin talks about so-called negative emissions yet to be invented, and I want to give you an interpretation as a metaphor. Imagine you're sitting in a soapbox car on a slippery slope, and as you pick up speed you realize that you have neither steering wheel nor brakes. But the faster you go, the more motivated you will be of having them. However, high speed in a wobbly soapbox car does not necessarily increase your capacity of actually inventing and mounting something that will help you slow down. If you didn't have it from the beginning, maybe you shouldn't pass the point of no return. But when it comes to emissions of greenhouse gases, we are very close. And as with most tipping points, you don't know where the line is until you have passed it. Now, enough of introduction from me and one-liners from Kevin. The only thing left before the interview is Kevin's presentation of himself and a drumbeat.
My name is Kevin Anderson. I'm Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, and I also hold a professorship at the University of Uppsala as the Climate Change Leadership Professor.
Yeah. Make yourself comfortable. And just to make sure that
I find the levels. What did you have for breakfast? That's a normal question.
No breakfast. I don't eat. You know, they always ask me that, and I always say I don't eat breakfast, or very seldom have breakfast. Oh. And so I had no breakfast again this morning.
Okay. When do you have your first meal?
Today was about 3 o'clock.
Oh, how do you survive?
I've never had a problem with that. In fact, when I was single, I used to just eat once a day in the evening, about 11 o'clock at night.
Hmm.
So I did that for years. I just ate once every day, late at night.
Right, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay, it's great to have you here. How come that you got so engaged in climate? Because you started as an engineer.
Yes, and I still think I have an engineer's mindset. But I started an engineer who also worked for quite a long time in the oil industry. I'd always had, it was right from being a child, I was very interested in environmental issues and energy issues. I lived next door to a nuclear power station where my dad worked as a what we call a fitter, someone who did the maintenance work on the reactor. So he used to talk about that all the time. He was very keen on energy issues. We used to discuss that from when I was very young. But also where I lived was actually a place that had a lot of countryside. So I really was quite interested in environmental issues, or in the environment. I appreciated the environment. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I got to a sort of reasonable age in my teens, I recognised my interest in energy, but also my interest in the environment. Climate wasn't an issue then. It was back in the sort of 70s and early 80s. Yeah. But then when I was working, later on as I trained as an engineer and I was working offshore on the oil platforms, I was noticing the spills that we were creating. I was noting the use of CFCs and trying to reduce that use offshore. So I was interested in these sorts of issues. And then climate change came to the fore towards the end of the 80s on a public sort of forum. And I decided that was something I wanted to know a lot more about. So I went back to university to find out more about it. And then I decided in the end that I probably could do more good from within university than going back into industry. Mm. So that was a very quick version of my story from being a child up to an academic.
Sometimes people, when they describe you as being a little bit radical.
Okay, yeah, that's
how, yeah. What is your response to that?
Well, it depends what you mean by radical. Well, do we think it's radical to, you know, the people who think I'm radical are probably like me. We live in this incredibly privileged elite group in the global society, and we think this is normal. So we have normalized our activity. We've normalized living in large houses, driving around in 2,000 kilograms or 1,500 kilograms of car to transport, in my case, 90 kilograms of flesh, a few kilometers to pick up, you know, a bit of groceries somewhere, that we can just fly around the world at the drop of a hat. This is a normal world. Isn't it sort of less radical to question whether that's a reasonable thing to be part of? And particularly when the science has told us now very clearly in relation to climate change, and indeed is starting to tell us much more in relation to sustainability, that it simply is not viable. So therefore...
Are we living in denial?
I think we are living in, we're somewhere between denial and delusion. Yeah. And I think because we only ever talk with people like ourselves, and the language that's often used about the climate skeptics is that they're in an echo chamber. Well, actually, we're all in that echo chamber. We often share a lot of space with the climate skeptics. We're all the wealthy group of the world that are causing the majority of these sorts of climate change issues. And we don't like the idea that we are the causes of this. So the best thing to do is to group together with people like ourselves and pretend it's someone else, or that it can be solved with some sort of technical, easy technical solution. So I do think that actually being in that group we live in a radical extreme group, and we have normalized it. And that is the real danger, that we don't recognize how bizarre and abstract our lifestyles have become.
How are we doing when it comes to solutions of the climate crisis or climate problems? Or
I think we are, we have plenty of solutions. Whether these are, some of these are technical, some of them are philosophical and social and economic and political. What we lack is the courage to put them in place. And I'm not saying these are simple single type solutions. They will vary from country to country, depending on our culture, depending on who we're aiming them at. But we have all the wherewithal we need now to deal with the climate change challenge. There will no doubt be some issues as we progress through that process, but we can start now dramatically reducing our emissions from those of us who are the high emitters. So we're not short of anything there, other than courage.
What prevented us from doing these things in the 70s?
Well, we didn't know enough about these issues in the 70s. I mean, really, I think, although some people have been talking about climate change for many years and right back into the 1800s, nevertheless, really, I don't think it became to significant political fore to the fore until probably sometime during the 1980s, and then obviously the 1990, the first IPCC report. So though we had the tools before, we didn't really have the problem sufficiently fleshed out. But I think by 1990, I think the first IPCC report was sufficiently robust to give us a very clear steer that, that any level of precaution or prudency would suggest that we should be making rapid changes in how we're using fossil fuels. And we've chosen to fail for 25, 27 years now since, a quarter of a century of failure.
Why?
Because when we start to think about it, it looks difficult. We would have to change the sites of energy we used. Those of us who use lots of that energy, which is, you know, a small number of us who use the majority of the energy, we'd have to significantly change our lifestyles. Once that started to come out, that becomes quite challenging. And when you think that's not just to those people, you know, the elite within which we live, but those of us within that elite who undertake the science, that starts to say to things to us like, it's problematic doing your field work. You can't fly to those international conferences. Your university shouldn't be aspiring to always attract more international students. So it, it asks fundamental questions about what we've normalized in our lives. And so there's a sort of cognitive dissonance there in that our research is telling us something.
Definitely, because if you know what you know, what you're saying, then you also know that it will be even more difficult in the future to sort of solve the problem, whatever the solution is, because we are heading for major climate impacts anyhow. Whatever we do, we will have a lot of climate change.
But I think there's two things there. Firstly, that I think what happened was that because we were with other groups of people like ourselves, that we had this collective delusion. And then the language you put around that, which was, in, I'm talking here maybe from a UK perspective, but also more widely as well, is that we started to focus on what can we do by 2050. That was a really common dialogue in the UK and elsewhere, but really dominant in the UK. And so when you think about what can we do by 2050, we can do lots by 2050. But the problem is that has almost nothing to do with the science. The science tells us it's the emissions that we put out between now and some point in the future that really matters for the temperature across the century. And that starts to say, well, actually, it's not about what you can do by 2050, but what can you do now? What can you do tomorrow? What about next week, in a few months' time, in 5 years' time? And that starts to bring the whole issue right back to actually how we do what we do today. So there's a delusion that a collective delusion we came to that 2050 was what mattered, when really that had no scientific foundation. It was politically expedient to use that sort of framework. And we sort of believed it, but even though deep down we knew it wasn't really appropriate. Yeah. And once we've got the sort of carbon budget framework that myself and other colleagues have been working on now since 2005, but now it's embedded in the IPCC, that actually that sort of framework leaves us very little wriggle room. You can't really escape that one. You know, once you realize it's a budget framework, you realize the more you use today, the less you can use tomorrow. Yeah. Then, you know, this, as the scientific community, as the climate change community, including the NGOs, we have to start to respond very quickly. And the way we've responded very quickly is to say, are there technologies in the future that can expand that budget that we have?
Just to say something, if we have the emissions that we have today, how long time do we have before we have to go to zero when it comes to the carbon budget?
Well, if we carried on like today for 1.5 degrees centigrade, I would argue within 3 to 10 years. I said 13 tonight, but probably
it's
even less than that.
Steep drop to zero.
But that would mean if we carried on as we're going now, we'd run out of all the budget by then. It would be zero overnight. Yeah, if we made no changes. And certainly within the 3 to 5 year time frame, it's hard to envision anything happening other than they could go up a bit, they could go down a bit, they could end up being stable. But nothing significant will happen, I don't think, in the next 3 to 5 years. So that's going to lock in quite a lot of climate change. In terms of 2 degrees centigrade, we're talking a little bit longer here. The work that I've done, which is fairly optimistic on the carbon budgets and that we don't have lots of other feedbacks, so I'm being quite optimistic here, is that if you had a weak element of equity into this, the poorer parts of the world need to be zero carbon energy by 2050 and need to be really moving towards mitigation, reducing their emissions by the very early 2020s. We need to start in the wealthier parts of the world right now reducing our emissions very rapidly indeed, certainly over 10% per annum, and need to be zero carbon energy by about 2035. So, you know, far more stringent than most of the climate science is suggesting. But I'm assuming no negative emission technologies in that analysis.
And then you say you're not calculating with a lot of feedbacks, the albedo feedbacks or methane or anything like that. Yeah. You said 10% per year.
10% per year for the wealthy parts of the world starting now, yeah. And we said that a couple of years ago. We were talking about 8 to 10% then. Now it's much nearer 10% and probably a little bit over that. When you start to differentiate that amongst the wealthy parts of the world, somewhere like the UK, the US, or Sweden indeed, you're talking about probably 12, 13% per annum, while some of the other slightly poorer countries like Greece and so forth would be a little bit lower rates of change because they need slightly longer to make that transition because they're a bit poorer.
And there will still be climate change that we have to adapt to?
Well, yes, I mean, 2 degrees C, there'll be significant climate change, particularly for poorer parts of the world, but I think that will affect us all. I think it was often the belief, well, I mean, really underneath it all, we think we're sufficiently far north, we'll be sufficiently resilient to climate change. We don't really care that much about the poorer communities elsewhere. The problem is the poorer communities elsewhere produce a lot of the food for us. So a lot of the food now is in some parts of the world, like where we are in Sweden or the UK, is imported. So it will affect the food market significantly and the price of food. But in addition, we'll see increased climate migrants. We've seen the problems that a few migrants from the Syrian crisis have caused within Europe. I'm not saying that's a climate change event, though some people say there was a climate change exacerbating factor, which is an interesting academic discussion. But nevertheless, what I'm simply saying here is when a moderate number of people arrive from Syria and so forth, we start to see the collapse of some of the sort of things that we spent years trying to put together in the EU, some sort of stability between these countries. If we talk about very serious levels of climate change, we're talking about very significant levels of climate migrants. How are we going to respond to that? And we've struggled to respond in a coordinated, compassionate fashion to what we've seen so far.
So the policymakers and politicians, etc., how do they respond to that?
If the microphone's away from them, quite a lot of them are saying, "Well, I just don't know what to do. I'm really stuck. I've got my electorate. I've got other pressures on my job." So we often like to think that those people are above us in a sort of a power sense. Other people with all the power, but of course they're not. They're also significantly constrained, right through to the ministers, the prime ministers, even with Trump. I mean, he's already seeing the constraints of the American system. It doesn't allow people just to do what they want. Perhaps that's a very good thing sometimes. They recognise quite a few of them recognise the challenge. Some of them would sort of say, I don't believe it's that bad, or surely it can't be that bad. But quite a few recognise that, this sounds reasonable to me as an interpretation of it. But what am I supposed to do? I feel as constrained as you do. That's why I don't think it's a top-down solution. I think the solution is a partnership between top-down and bottom-up. What I mean bottom-up, I mean individuals catalysing change in their local environment, whether that's the place they work or their sports club or the local community. We need to see those examples, and then the top-down approach is that they have to look for the examples that are out there and say, how do I scale that up at a national level? Mm. So unless we start to see that partnership between the two, I think we're not going to resolve climate change.
How close are we to geoengineering initiatives?
Well, we're certainly talking about them with seriously now. Whether we think they're going to be an appropriate policy response to climate change or not is a different matter. In my view, they're a dangerous distraction. I think we should be researching them, but we should assume they do not work. I say that both for negative emission technologies and the geoengineering technologies as well. I have no problems with them being researched and developed, but I do have serious problems if we think these things are going to work. So let's do everything we possibly can to mitigate. And if some of these things work, maybe we can hold the 2 degrees C, or even 1.5 if we're incredibly lucky on the negative emissions. But if we rely on them and they fail, then the future will be a complete disaster. And at the moment, there's no reason to believe they will succeed at scale.
When you communicate, you use a lot of storytelling and metaphors. I've noticed. Have you been thinking of it?
I do think metaphors and storytelling and narratives are important. I hadn't really thought about the ones that I'm particularly using. I would suggest that we need the creative communities to engage in this issue, because they're the ones that are very good at that. And we also have to be careful, though, not to misuse metaphors, because metaphors work as a temporary analogy, but then you have to break them, because and there can be a danger in extending them too far. So maybe I do use them. I have to stop and think about that. I hadn't really consciously thought that through before.
No, but you talk about the scientists and what you're using yourself as an example, for instance, when you go to conferences, etc. You haven't been flying since 2004.
Yes, I wouldn't call that a metaphor. I just think it's important for those of us who work on climate change.
That's a good example. That's not a metaphor. It's a story about you can live a good life and still not use aviation.
Yeah, you can. That's very true. And also, there's some interesting academic work. There's a paper out last year that shows that the credibility of the research of academics is improved if they broadly move their lives to match what their research demonstrates. That's an academic paper that showed that very clearly, and there's other work out there that demonstrates that as well. So it doesn't change, of course, the quality of the research, but people take more note of it.
Can you say something about the difference between low carbon and zero carbon?
Well, here I'm particularly talking about energy, in that what appears to be the case is that from the other sources of greenhouse gases significantly related to agriculture and land use is that we can't eliminate those emissions altogether. There will be some emissions associated with them. And therefore, we need to really get the emissions out of the energy system, which we can get down to zero. I mean, we do not have to burn any fossil fuels for generating energy or producing energy. And that's why very low or low is not good enough. And when people talk about carbon capture and storage, sort of say this is the way forward, it still has very very high life cycle emissions, probably somewhere in the region of 100 to 200 grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour, compared with, say, 5 to 15 or so for renewables and nuclear. So we need to get right down to that sort of 5 to 15, and ideally then once we get the system even further down, that will drop to virtually zero, if not zero carbon emissions. And we need to do that because the carbon remains in the atmosphere and builds up in the atmosphere. It's a cumulative issue. And if we don't get emissions down of carbon, then what you'll get is a gradual and slow, okay, slow, but ongoing build-up and an ongoing change in temperature. So we need to get zero carbon emissions.
In the communication of climate, we talk a lot about the temperature in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
More than 90% of the energy imbalance is stored in the oceans.
Yeah.
And the carbon dioxide, you mentioned it just briefly, half of it stays in the atmosphere and the other half goes into the biosphere and the oceans.
Yeah, yeah. Half into the plants, half into the ocean.
Yeah, and what about the part that goes into the ocean, with the acidification of the oceans?
Well, that's an important issue. I mean, it's one that there was a lot of science being undertaken on this, and I think nothing's very clear about it, except for the fact that what we always know, of course, is that if you go in and seriously interrupt a very stable ecosystem quite rapidly, then generally you're not going to get very positive results. So it seems very foolish to think it's appropriate to be acidifying the ocean at the rate we are acidifying it. But the other thing we also know is the oceans warm up. They hold a lot of carbon dioxide. They hold far more carbon dioxide than the atmosphere. And as they warm up, it's more difficult for them to hold that carbon dioxide. So it will start to vent and release, or it could start to vent and release back into the atmosphere. Though initially what we'll see is the oceans just stop being a sink. So they won't absorb it. So I mean, if they didn't absorb what they absorb today, which is probably in the region of sort of 10 billion tons of carbon dioxide, roughly a quarter of what we put out, then that becomes really problematic. Yeah, so more of what we put in the atmosphere stays in the atmosphere. Ongoing increased warming, which means the oceans will slowly warm as well, which means they can't hold as much CO2. They put more back in the atmosphere. So you get this potential sort of feedback.
Are we just locked into this? Because this has happened before with the albedo effect and the greenhouse gases, like normal climate change when you have the Milankovitch cycles going back and forth and the feedback loops and in the climate system in itself. And we tend to focus on time span, which is a couple of decades or centuries, but eventually what we put into the atmosphere first goes down to the oceans. And if it doesn't sort of stay in the oceans or in the rock or in the soil or whatever, it will be returned to the atmosphere as it gets warmer.
It's all a matter of the time frame over which these things occur. If these things occur very slowly, then, which is what some science is sort of suggesting, if we can hold the emissions very low, or get the emissions down low very quickly, then we can probably deal with the increased warming. If, as other people suggest, actually these sort of suites of feedbacks and so forth, we've already started to trigger them, then we are likely to see ongoing increased warming. But what within the science, there are cogent arguments made for both sides of that debate. So if we were prudent and precautionary, we would say that, well, we need to do everything we can now because there is a risk, and potentially a serious risk, that we could set in train a whole suite of feedbacks. The less cautious, the less prudent side of the science is, and they're still just as valid, the science, but they're less cautious and prudent, I would argue, in terms of their response to it, would be that, oh, well, I think we can go quite a lot further before we start to trigger these feedbacks. And that's a very dangerous game to play, in my view. So it's like it's the Russian roulette. You wouldn't want to do it at all. And the first group say taking one pull of the trigger, and the other group say, "Well, I'm happy to take three or four pulls of the trigger." Well, I don't think that's particularly wise to do with the future of society, or indeed many ecosystems.
Yeah, you mentioned the time frame. What time frame should we be interested in when we talk about these things? Is it 100 years? 50 years? Our lifetime? Three generations?
Well, it depends where you live, I think, as well. But in terms of the mitigation, it's now. It's now over the next 20 years, really. So it's immediately, as in what we do today and tomorrow, and what we do then over that period between now and, say, 2030, 2040, really, that's the time frame. But the impacts, although the provisional impacts, the early impacts are being felt now by some of the poorer parts of the world, the other sort of wider set of impacts will play out increasingly across the century. So we are talking about our children's future. But significantly, I'm 54. I mean, I would expect, I live a sort of reasonably average life in the UK, then I would expect to see some very significant levels of climate change going through my life, with implications affecting most of the ways that we would live our lives in the wealthy Western part of the world. For children of my generation, for the children in the next generation, I think they're going to be living through, unless we do something very significant on climate change, fairly dire futures, with considerable levels of international instability, rapid changes in the climate and therefore the weather and the extremes, all within infrastructure and a way of living and thinking about the world that we have now that has evolved to a very stable period of climate. That's the, one of the issues, is that we have evolved and come and to where we are today, which is, you know, tremendous achievements. We've done that against a backdrop of a really very stable climate, and we're talking about changing the climate very rapidly indeed. And I don't think we have the infrastructure wherewithal, the institutional wherewithal, or possibly the intellectual and moral wherewithal to deal with that. So I think it would be incredibly dangerous if we go in that direction, and we should be trying everything we can to minimise the temperature rise and therefore the levels of climate change that we are set to see.
So what do you think is going to happen? Can you name a couple of scenarios that will happen? Because obviously no one knows what's going to happen but some different scenarios.
Well, my yeah, people often ask me if I'm an optimist or a pessimist. I don't see myself as an optimist or a pessimist. I see myself just as a realist. I work on climate change because I think we are choosing to fail, but we could choose to succeed. There is a choice in there. And when many mean succeed, I think we could hold the temperature rise to about 2 degrees centigrade. I think that is still viable. If you ask me in 5 years or 10 years' time, I probably would say it would no longer be viable. I think it's still viable just today. I don't think 1.5 is any longer viable unless the negative emission technologies work and then work at scale. And that's a very big if. So we could choose to succeed. My guess about the future is that we will choose to fail. And let's not pretend that it's not a choice. It is a choice. And that we will choose a future of 3 or 4 degrees C for our children and for their children, maybe even higher for their children. And we will choose devastation from many of the poorer, climatically vulnerable parts of the world who have caused none of this problem at all. So that's my scenario, is that we will choose to fail. And then probably some long point in the future, we'll look back, if we're fortunate enough to be in that position, to rue the day when we decided to ignore the science, to ignore any moral framework, to follow a short-term ephemeral diktat that has overly influenced our society for 20 or 30 years. And we have essentially, even the scientists have effectively ignored the physics, the basic laws, you know, the laws of nature that we've come to understand reasonably well. We've ignored them in some sort of arrogant hope that we would be able to find some sort of technologies or ways that we would be able to protect ourselves in the future. So I have a very sort of dystopian view of the future, but the reason I work on climate change is because we can choose to avoid that if we want. Mm. Once I think it's too late, I'll not work on it anymore. I would be only too happy to work on something else. Mm. So you know, I hope the climate skeptics are right. Much more than they do.
That was a pretty dystopian view of the future, but at the same time you have to fill people with hope. And as NGOs and politicians and people have been doing for the last decades, that we can save the climate and we can fix this, etc. As long as you travel less with airplanes and you lower the temperature and you compensate and you do this and that. Or do you think it's fooling people to give them the story of that we can fix this?
I think it depends who you're talking to. So who's talking about it? I think as an academic, I think we only really have one job to do. Well, one job with two roles. One is to do research carefully and meticulously. And the second is to communicate it bluntly, not to sugarcoat it. So as I said before, I think we will choose to fail. I think failure will be disastrous for other species and for our own children and probably for many of our own lives itself as well. But I also, from my work, show that, whether we call it hope or not, show that there is a route to avoid the more extreme end of climate change. And we know the things we need to do. We have the tools available. We have the wherewithal. We have the intellectual capacity. We seem to lack any sort of moral fiber or courage to point us in that direction at the moment. So, you know, there is significant hope. The reason I get engaged, the reason I do talk about this, is because I think we can do something about climate change, something significant about climate change. But we will only do that when we stop deluding ourselves. And I don't just mean, you know, the politicians or the companies. I also mean the climate scientists as well. I think we've deluded ourselves for too long that we can technically find a way out of this. This is far more than technology has a really major role to play, but it's a prerequisite, but it is not sufficient.
What about the incentives, the leverage points? Where do we find them?
I think that they are very culturally specific. So I think the leverage points in Sweden will be different from the UK, and probably they'll be very different from places like China. So I think we have to set a framework up within which countries can then choose what is the most appropriate way for them to do something. So yeah, Sweden's quite a different society to the UK. You have a much closer relationship sort of civil contract between society and the government, you have much more trust for your authorities than somewhere like the UK. So probably the policy tools and levers you would use would be different from the ones we would use. But we all know what we need to do. You know, we know what the sectors are, we know where the missions come from that need to be severely curtailed. So we know what the tools are, we know what the sectors are, we know what the technical tools are. What we need to think about much more is what's the appropriate culturally specified policy levers we have to pull.
And how do we find out?
Well, by starting to try them. So in Sweden, it would seem to me that you've got a proposed climate law coming up, and that if that's, firstly, Sweden does demonstrate, is often seen as something of an international leader. So let's see it show some international leadership there. Let's see it develop its climate law in line with what it is signed up to deliver in Paris, around 2 degrees centigrade, and in line with the science. And that would mean that it would start to think about what its carbon budget would be, how that might be split between the different municipalities and the communes, what that would mean for some of the policies it put in place, like, for instance, some of the things I was talking about tonight, you know, a moratorium on airport expansion, a frequent flyer levy, trying to rapidly upgrade your train network, having strong arguments with Volvo. They need to be looking towards much, much more efficient, and then moving away from fossil fuel-based cars. So, you know, with the housing stock in Sweden, I've heard tonight, to my surprise, that the housing stock is not as efficient as I thought it was. A significant amount of energy is used to heat the houses. You have much bigger houses per square foot, per square meter rather, than per person, than in somewhere like the UK. These are all things that need to be addressed. So all new buildings should be passive house, or ideally actually should generate their own energy. Perhaps you have to think about smaller properties with, or smaller meter squareage per person. So you can sort of see a whole suite of options out there which will change some of the technologies and some of the ways we have to live our lives. But alongside that, I think we need to be starting to say, what is it that's important about our lives? And this is where I think there's more hope in Sweden, that your value system isn't yet quite as simplified as it is in somewhere like the UK or the US, where value is just simply, what do you own? How much stuff do you consume? How big is your house? How big is your car? Do you fly first class, and how far do you go? And that pretty much says what you need to know about a person in the UK or the States. There still seems to be something a bit richer and deeper in Sweden. You haven't forgone some of those other values. And I think the climate law and things within the government need to say, how do we foster that? How do we engender these other forms of value? How do we give them a space to be able to compete with this simple financial metric that's dominated much of the discourse over the last 20 or 30 years?
That's great.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
Scientists, politicians, stakeholders, and other people who claim they know something about the climate, they draw some quite different conclusions about the severity of the matter and how to deal with the consequences. Kevin offers a rough categorization of people into four different groups depending on their interpretation of climate. First, we have the denialists. They think that the world is about 6,000 years old and that God provided us with fossil reserves to prosper from. They also think that climate science is fundamentally flawed. Then we have the skeptics. They agree with most of the scientific conclusions, but they think the so-called climate sensitivity is low. That means you can pollute, but not much will happen with global warming. They also think it's more important to let the economy grow and hence get a net positive result that easily can deal with whatever small impact from climate changes. Thirdly, you have the incrementalists. They think that the science is correct and that climate is an important and unmitigated, the changes will be large, but it can be fixed. You just put a price on CO2, not so high it will harm the economy, and you also expect some future technological solution that will take care of some eventual problems in the future. We can meet the Paris Agreement with small steps and within the current socio-economic paradigm. It's very comfortable to be here. You don't deny science, you support engineering solutions, and you can basically continue business as usual. Number four, the radicals or realists. They say that the science is correct and climate change is an urgent matter, but there is no way we will mitigate the climate and stay below 2 degrees, not to mention 1.5 degrees Celsius, without a real shift away from today's GDP growth mentality and paradigm. We no longer have the option with small step adjustments, and we cannot rely on some future technology that might suck CO2 out of the air or some geoengineering solutions. If we're serious about fulfilling the Paris Agreement and avoid catastrophes, we need radical shift in emissions, about 10% per year. We have the technology to shift to renewable energy, but it needs to scale up with magnitude. We can do it, but of course it will have some profound implications on business as usual. It's uncomfortable, but realistic. And do I need to emphasize that this is the category where you will find Kevin?
So I have a very sort of dystopian view of the future. But the reason I work on climate change is because we can choose to avoid that if we want. Once I think it's too late, I'll not work on it anymore. I would be only too happy to work on something else. We have plenty of solutions. Whether these are, some of these are technical, some of them are philosophical and social and economic and political. What we lack is the courage to put them in place.
If you want to know more about Kevin Anderson and his research, you will find him at his webpage, kevinanderson.info. And if you like the show Beyond One Degree, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or the place where you collect your podcasts. And if you have any comments, please post them at our website, beyondonedegree.com, or on Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is that clear?
That was very clear. Okay, fine. That was good.